Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of From My Point of View. We have a bit of housekeeping to start the episode. Some football news, a couple of trades, big trades, a retirement of arguably the greatest defensive player of all time, Aaron Donald. Our MLB season preview, which I wrote an entire blog about all 30 teams, my predictions for each team going into 2024, how I think they'll finish. You can go read that on animalhouseusa.com. But I will be quickly recapping some of my thoughts and opinions on today's episode. And of course, March Madness is here. We have the play-ins on Wednesday and the first round of the tournament on Thursday. Very, very, very exciting. I love March Madness. Do a bracket every year. It's busted by the second weekend every year. So a couple years ago, I think I did pretty well. I finished like top five, I'm pretty sure. And I had some good teams. I literally just filled this out this morning. I entered a pool with my friends, and I filled one out this morning. Obviously, the committee thing was on Sunday, so I'm gonna probably tweak with this over the next like day and a half before Wednesday. So I'll have, right now it's Monday afternoon I'm recording this. So I'll have, yeah, like a day and a half to maybe tinker with it. There are some picks, some upsets. I'll go over some of the upsets I have in the first two weekends. I'll give you my Elite Eight, Final Four, and Championship Game plus Champion. But before we get to that, we will start with our football news. So first and foremost, as mentioned, one of the greatest defensemen in the NFL, Aaron Donald, has called it quits. He hinted at it post-Super Bowl win a few years ago. Maybe he might retire. People were like, oh my God, is this true? Blah, blah, blah. Played a couple more years and now has, after 10 seasons, decided to hang it up. And what an absolutely dominant 10 years it was. 10 years. 8 first team all pros. If you go to his pro football reference page, it's so funny. It's just like a cross each year that represents he made an all pro team, first team all pro team. The only time he didn't win it was last time he wasn't an all pro was last year in 2022. And his rookie season, he won defensive rookie of the year. He proceeded to win defensive player of the year 3 other times in his career. Just an absolute monster. So an 8-time first team all pro, 3 defensive player of the year awards, 1 defensive rookie of the year award, and a future first ballot Hall of Famer, 1-time Super Bowl champ as well. Of course, you can't forget that. He's only 32 years old, a young career, just 10 years in the league, but maybe arguably the most dominant 10 years anybody has ever had across any sport. There isn't anything he hasn't won. Aside from an MVP, and that is the one some people are saying he has an argument to be the GOAT in terms of like defensive players. I don't necessarily disagree with you. However, I would like to point out that Lawrence Taylor won an MVP in the NFL as a linebacker. So until further notice, he is the greatest defensive player of all time. It's Lawrence Taylor. I think most people would agree it's Lawrence Taylor. But Aaron Donald, you talk about top 5. He's probably the greatest I think he's the greatest defensive tackle of all time. Like, he's not even, this is a guy who racked up all these sacks. He was as dominant and as big as a game wrecker as he was as a tackle. You know, a lot of these guys, when you talk about game wreckers on defense, they're edge rushers. Aaron Donald wasn't an edge rusher. He's getting double teamed by 2 guards, and maybe sometimes he's getting chipped. He's always getting chipped by a tight end or a running back. That never really works. So he's constantly being double teamed and still winning his matchups. Like, just pure strength. He might be the strongest defensive lineman of all time as well. Like, he is a absolute freak and a game wrecker at a defensive tackle position that doesn't necessarily have that kind of, you don't expect that kind of productivity from a defensive tackle the way Aaron Donald delivered that productivity. He was absolutely sensational. The scariest dude on the defensive line for 10 straight years and a guy that you always looked at when going against the Rams. And you talk about defensive players at each position. I said he's the greatest defensive tackle of all time. I think that's pretty clear. And you throw up the top four defensive players of all time. Lawrence Taylor, maybe Deion Sanders you throw in there, the best defensive back of all time. A lot of people consider him to be the best defensive back of all time. Deion Sanders, maybe Reggie White, Aaron Donald. Reggie White, maybe, you know, I think he might, you can probably find someone maybe that can knock off Reggie White or even Deion Sanders. But Lawrence Taylor, Aaron Donald, Reggie White, Deion Sanders, like, that's not a bad route, Mount Rushmore. That's just off the top of my head. But Aaron Donald, I mean, how it's hard to argue against why he isn't the best defensive player of all time. Like, it's more so that you have a better argument for Lawrence Taylor rather than saying, well, this is why Aaron Donald isn't. It's more so that this is why Lawrence Taylor still is. You know what you get what I'm saying? You understand? That's the kind of difference that we're looking at here. That's like the very thin difference between these guys. Just an unbelievable football player. And apparently he told Sean McVay after their loss to the Detroit Lions, I'm full. I don't know if he meant he's not hungry anymore for the grind or his heart's full and he's content. But either way, I think it works. And clearly, he's literally had his fill. He's done everything. He's won multiple Defensive Player of the Year awards. He's 8-time All-Pro. Everyone considers him one of the best defensive players of all time. He has a Super Bowl, which I think was the one thing that I could see why, you know, if he decided to hang it up after the Super Bowl, that's probably why, where he was just like, I got the last thing that I really wanted. And that was to like stand on top of everybody and be like, we did it. We're the best. We accomplished the ultimate goal in team sports, to win a championship. And I could see why, if he was really ready to retire than he was. But I think maybe for his teammates, to see if he can run it back, especially that, you know, they run it back. It's a bad 2022. The Rams aren't good. Kind of a nightmare, honestly. So you run it back one more time after that. They get into the playoffs. He's a all pro again. Get back into the playoffs. You have an emotional matchup, maybe not emotional for him, but certainly for Stafford and Goff and McVay and the Rams versus the Lions. An emotional playoff game, a very, very tight, down-to-the-wire playoff game. And they end up losing, and that's it. That's your last hurrah. I imagine after winning the Super Bowl, Aaron Donald didn't want to retire when the next year it just kind of fell apart. There were injuries everywhere. Stafford got injured. You know, they lost some players. They were just really weren't – it just – Clear that they sold their soul for that Super Bowl. They sold everybody. They sold their draft picks. They traded a bunch, all their picks away for all these players. And then a lot of those players had to end up leaving because they couldn't pay all of them. It was just a cap nightmare. And there's no real, like, wasn't really sure where the future was going. And somehow, some way, Matt Stafford, because he's that good, Matthew Stafford was able to bring them back with a full healthy season and bring him back to the playoffs. And Donald was like, all right, this is probably my last go around. Let's try and win it all. They lose to the Lions, and then that's it. So a great career for Aaron Donald. The Los Angeles Rams Twitter account posted a great graphic with Donald in like a 3-point stance. And all it said was, quarterbacks rejoice. That's pretty sick. that's a pretty sick graphic. Yeah, that was awesome. So congratulations to Aaron Donald and a happy retirement. Couple trades. So first, actually a signing first, the Titans signing Calvin Ridley. It was like a 4-year, $90 million contract, something like that. I'm not sure how much was guaranteed. Pretty crazy. I don't really understand what the Titans are doing, but pretty crazy to, you know, trade AJ Brown away to the Eagles because you didn't want to pay him. the extension he was asking for. And then like 2 years later, you pay Calvin Ridley basically the same exact contract, an older Calvin Ridley. You didn't want to pay a 24-year-old, I think, AJ Brown that money, but you'll pay like a 30-year-old Calvin Ridley that money. So doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. Kind of a weird contract to dish out. On top of that, they signed Tony Pollard, who, along with Burks in the back in the backfield, not really different. They have like the same skill set, basically. So you have like two of the same running backs in the backfield now. You got Will Levis somebody, I guess that was the plan. But none of this is going to be happening under Mike Vrabel's watch. So maybe that kind of tells you what you need to know, that the Titans, I have no idea what sense of direction the Titans have, because they're handing out these contracts. I don't know. It feels bizarre to me. It feels very weird, and not something that I feel like has any real true sense of direction for Tennessee. The Vikings traded up for the Texans first round pick, or they traded for the Texans first round pick. They didn't trade up. They already have a higher pick than the Texans, but they traded for the Texans first round pick, which many believe is a direct indication that the Vikings are going to bundle the two first round picks that they have now and possibly a future first round pick to move up in the draft to select a quarterback. Because as it stands right now, Sam Darnold is the starting quarterback for the Minnesota Vikings, which no knock on Sam Darnold. Since leaving the Jets, which was obviously a dumpster fire situation, he's bounced around. He just had a year in San Francisco where he was the backup under Purdy, studying under Kyle Shanahan's offense. Could be a bright spot, could be something that people look at and say, hey, maybe, you know, he learned a thing or two. The physical talent is still kind of there. Let's see maybe if he can do something in Minnesota under Kevin O'Connell. So, but right now it feels like that is the most likely move, that they're going to try and trade up. I don't know who they're going to try and trade up with, because as of right now, it feels like all three of the top picks are going to be quarterbacks. So I don't know who they're going to trade with, but right now, and that leads us, we mentioned that trade real quick, and that'll lead us to the Steelers situation. So the Steelers, they signed Russell Wilson to a one-year deal. Immediately, Kenny Pickett's like, I'm not going to be, this is a lose-lose situation for me. Let me go somewhere else. So they traded him to the Eagles. And now Kenny Pickett will be the backup to Jalen Hurts, and he'll just kind of chill there in Philadelphia. Not really sure what the difference is, if you ask me. Because instead of being sitting behind Russell Wilson for a year, where maybe you can learn a thing or two, maybe you can kind of try and develop a little bit more, you get traded to the Eagles, where you're now behind a talented, young, about 10 years younger quarterback, and you're really not going to get an opportunity to play there. So I'm not really sure what Kenny Pickett's career trajectory is anymore, but he is now the backup for the Philadelphia Eagles. And the Steelers, in turn, when they got rid of Kenny Pickett, they made a move for Justin Fields from the Chicago Bears. And apparently Ryan Poles, who I've been critical of Ryan Poles, I'm more critical of Matt Eberflus. I think he's kind of a problem, and he could prove me wrong this year, and I could end up eating these words. But Ryan Poles has done a very good job this offseason. Clearly, they had a sense of direction. Everyone was speculating after the season, well, Justin Fields can play. Maybe the Bears shouldn't trade him. Those people actually saying that don't even understand what they're talking about, because you'd have to pay Justin Fields eventually. And it's just better for the franchise moving forward to draft Caleb Williams, have control of him for 5 years on his rookie deal, and pay other people to support him. That's the way. This is the way of team building. And that's what the Bears did. They retained Jalen Johnson. They signed, Kevin Byard. They traded for Keenan Allen from the Chargers. And now Justin Herbert has absolutely no one. I think Jim Harbaugh is just going to run the ball down everyone's throat, because I don't really know what Justin Herbert's going to throw, who Justin Herbert's going to throw to. But Keenan Allen, yes, injury history. Yes, he's like 32. But last year he proved when he's healthy, he's still very, very, very good. So you get Keenan Allen. You sign DeAndre Swift. You have weapons on offense and defense, and now you're going to get a rookie quarterback who is stepping into, shockingly, because it's the Chicago Bears, shockingly stepping into a very good situation, honestly. Like, you could not have asked Ryan Poles to do more with what he had to support drafting Caleb Williams. He's done as much as he possibly could, in my opinion, without going overboard. A lot of these are good, friendly deals. You know, you didn't give a lot of money to DeAndre Swift. You have Keenan Allen. You retain Jalen Johnson, who's one of the best defensive backs in the NFL. Just a lot of good moves from Ryan Poles here to put Caleb Williams in a supportive environment. Justin Fields, unfortunately, didn't work out with him. He suffered from a lot of how young quarterbacks suffer when they get drafted to dysfunctional franchises. He came in, two head coaches, multiple offensive coordinators, no sense of direction whatsoever, no real proper environment to grow and hone his skills and learn in the NFL. He didn't have any of that. So Ryan Poles did right by him, because apparently there were a couple trade offers on the table for Justin Fields, but Fields asked Poles, trade me to the Steelers. Poles obliged. I think that's very cool. I think that's very honorable. You know, I don't think the Bears were going to get much more for what they did from the Steelers. They got a sixth round pick that becomes a fourth round pick based on playing time for Justin Fields. However, the Steelers have already said Justin Fields will not be competing with Russell Wilson for the starting job, which I think is a very smart move. And so the Steelers, rather than maybe they could have gotten a fifth round pick from someone else, they take the sixth round pick for Fields. They wipe their hands clean, shake hands with Fields, say, good luck to you, sir. We're going to go start our new direction as a franchise. But we wish you nothing but the best. I respect that to Ryan Poles. That's a good move for him. Good karma move for sure. And now Justin Fields, I think, is in a good situation. I think Ryan Poles said in his statement that he released, we tried to find the best situation for both Justin and the Bears. And I think he did exactly that. The Bears are in a good position. You know, a sixth round pick isn't great, but it's not nothing. You know, that can turn into something. But you get draft compensation. You send him where he wants to go. Like I said, that's good karma. And Justin Fields now is in a situation in Pittsburgh under Mike Tomlin where this is a franchise that they've had their problems, and they've had their problems over the last few years. But these problems escalated they had problems when Big Ben was at the end of his career, but the problems all escalated when Big Ben retired. They've had no real quarterback direction. And now, suddenly, you signed Patrick Queen. Great pickup for the defense. Patrick Queen and TJ Watt as your linebackers is, like, scary business. But defense has never been the issue for the Steelers. So, you have a great defense. You got to work on your offensive line a little bit more. But now you have Russell Wilson in here on a vet minimum contract, one-year deal. He's the starter. Fields will not be competing for the starting job. And we'll see how far that goes, because I'm sure, you know, if we're 6, 7, 8 games into the season and the Steelers have like 3 wins, people are going to be like, oh, give Justin Fields a spin. You know, let's see what he can do. We know what he can do. We know what he's capable of. They showed these stats in the morning about, you know, this is how Fields has played in his last 20 games. And they're like comparable stats to Lamar Jackson, which I think is being very disingenuous. Obviously, Justin Fields is not the same kind of player Lamar Jackson is, and the Ravens are a much better football team than Chicago Bears. So, you know, you take those kind of comparisons with a grain of salt, a huge grain of salt, but Justin Fields has the physical talent. I think my biggest concern with him is his ability to just read a defense. I think when you watch, there's a ton of YouTube channels you can go and see real. I'm not just making this up. There are professionals who break down film and show you that Justin Fields flat out is late on a ton of his reads. That's just the way it is. And even when he sees his first read and it's not there or it's covered, he goes into full panic mode. So a lot of the film isn't great. You can see exactly what the problems are with him, but physically speaking, he has a good arm. He can run. And if you just, I mean, obviously he was in a very unstable environment. Like I said, multiple head coaches, multiple offensive coordinators. That doesn't help anything. Going into an environment with Mike Tomlin, with the Steelers, who have this direction now where it's like Russell Wilson, the Super Bowl winning quarterback on a vet minimum. Yes, he hasn't been very good the last couple years, but you get him in there on the Steelers. You try and find what works with him. You let him tutor Justin Fields, because that seems to be something that Russ is interested in, because he tweeted out, "Great QB room, let's get to work at Justin Fields," right? He tweeted at him. So he seems to be excited of the prospect of kind of mentoring Justin Fields. And I think Fields really needs that. I think he really needs someone who has been through it, who has won football games, who has won a Super Bowl, has been to multiple Super Bowls, to kind of show him the way. And Mike Tomlin, on top of that, I think is going to be a very strong presence in Justin Fields' life. Not just the football. And I'm not even just talking just about his football career. I'm talking about like his life in general. I think Mike Tomlin's going to take a strong connection to Justin Fields. So that's good for him. I think he's in a good situation. He wanted to be there. Justin Fields did. He understood that, you know, his career was not going the way maybe he had hoped, obviously. And this was an opportunity to kind of take the pressure off himself and sit back and just absorb information and learn. And ideally, if you're the Steelers, this all works out. Russell Wilson wins you a couple games. Maybe you're competitive. He teaches Justin Fields a thing or two, even if you don't make the playoffs, you know, and things work out. Wilson goes his own way. Maybe he even retires after this year. And then you hand the reins over to Justin Fields, who is still young and is pretty talented. So you give him the reins and hopefully it all works out for Pittsburgh and they finally get another stable quarterback for the future of their franchise. I like the move for both ends. I think there's a lot of upside for the Steelers. Who knows if it's going to work out, but I think just the idea of what they're trying to do in a bad situation, because no disrespect to Kenny Pickett, he wasn't that good, but he also was not in a good circumstance. Like, he was not supported. He had a horrible offensive line. He had maybe the worst play caller in all of football in Matt Canada for a season and a half. Bad. Not as bad as field situation in Chicago, but still not great. So that's a couple trades that happened. And I think that's about all the football news I had. We had Aaron Donald, the Fields and Pickett trade with the Steelers, the Vikings trading for the Texans first round pick with the possibility that they might be moving up or be trying to move up in the draft. And I said, by the way, back to that real quick, the top three picks are probably all going to be quarterbacks, because Washington also traded away Sam Howell. They traded him to Seattle, where now Drew Locke is on the Giants, where apparently he's going to be competing for the starting job with Daniel Jones. So they signed Drew Locke. He's out of Seattle. Seattle trades for Sam Howell from Washington. Now Washington has no quarterback. So they have the number two overall pick. Who are they going to take? It kind of seems like it's going to be Jaden Daniels now, but it might still be Drake May. I'm not really sure. I haven't really been tapped into the Washington Commanders rumor mill, but it's going to be one of those two guys, because the Bears are taking Caleb number one. Number two is going to be either Jaden Daniels or Drake May. And I would assume whoever the Commanders take at two, the Patriots will take the other option at three, because the Patriots need a quarterback. However, I think with the Patriots, if it's Jaden Daniels or Drake May, regardless of who it is, I think they sit in the Patriots system for a year behind Jacoby Brissett, who they just signed, who is a valuable backup and also a solid bridge quarterback kind of guy where they can let him, you know, Mahomes sitting behind Alex Smith type situation where you just let him sit there. You give the veteran the reins. The Patriots aren't winning anything this year. You know, it's a complete overhaul, new coaching staff, new head coach for the first time in 25 years. Just brand new everything. Brand new everything. So let May or Daniel sit behind Brissett for a year. Maybe you give him a run the last like couple weeks of the season, but definitely not like before the halfway point or any time close to that. Let him sit for a while, let him gather himself, learn the NFL offense, learn the system, because I think Jaden Daniels and Drake May are much less refined than Caleb Williams is, and just like physically less talented, in my opinion. So they would benefit more from sitting for a year, whereas Caleb Williams, I think, is ready to just throw him into the fire and he'll be good. But yeah, so whoever it ends up going 2-3, whether it's Drake May, Jaden Daniels, or Jaden Daniels, Drake May, Washington's not gonna have a choice. They're gonna play them. Offer it. I think they're gonna have to play them. But for the Patriots, I think the smarter move would be to just let them sit for a year. So I don't know. With the Vikings, like, they got this extra first round pick. I'm not really sure if they're going to be able to bundle up picks and players to move up in the draft for a quarterback. I don't know who that. Maybe they trade them to the Patriots, but this feels like the Patriots, like, it's, they're going for a quarterback. They need a young quarterback. They got rid of Mac Jones. Like, I don't see why they wouldn't draft a quarterback, to be honest, or why they would trade back. All right, let's go into March Madness. I was going to do the MLB preview, but let's do March Madness. March Madness, the selection show was Sunday afternoon. Couple big snubs, Seton Hall, St. John's out of the tournament. Virginia gets a play-in game, which is disgusting. Michigan State with 14 losses is disgusting. The fact Rick Pitino and St. John's, I think they're the biggest snub. Seton Hall is pretty close. Seton Hall is a bad snub too, and I think St. John's is probably worse, but really bad snubs on that end. That's basically the only complaint I have, is that Seton Hall and St. John's didn't get in. But have my bracket right here. You can hear that. A couple of upsets that I have off rip. We're getting right into this. I'm not going over the seeding. I'm not going over it. You can look that up yourself. It takes way too long to go over 68 teams or whatever it is. So some of the upsets I have. Grand Canyon beating St. Mary's. That's a 12-5 upset. There's a lot of 12-5 upsets, and I was almost convincing myself to pick every single 12-5 upset. I almost convinced myself. But we have in the East, in the Elite Eight, I have UConn, number one UConn versus number three Illinois. In the West, I have number one North Carolina versus number two Arizona. In the Midwest, I have number nine TCU versus number three Creighton. And in the South, I have number four Duke versus number three Kentucky. So in my final four, I have UConn, North Carolina, 2-1 seeds. And in the right side of my bracket, I have Kentucky, Creighton, which is 2 number 3 seeds. My big upsets, I have McNeese beating Gonzaga. That's another 12-5 matchup in the first round. I have James Madison beating Wisconsin. That's another 12-5 matchup. Other big upsets. I mentioned Grand Canyon beating St. Mary's as an upset. And I believe that is it. Moving forward into the tournament, I have TCU in the Midwest knocking off Purdue in the second round of the tournament to advance to the Sweet 16. And I think, what else? I have Washington State beating Iowa State to get to the Sweet 16 to play Illinois. That is about, I have JMU as one of my upsets, but I have them losing to Duke in the second part of the weekend. I think that's it as far as I can see. So again, I have in my Elite Eight, UConn versus North Carolina, and Kentucky versus Creighton, And I have the championship game being UNC versus Kentucky, a blue blood matchup. And I have Kentucky winning it all right now, which I know is shocking, but KenPom, baby. KenPom. Look it up. UConn has a very rough bracket. I mean, they have San Diego State, made a run last year, Illinois, Iowa State, Auburn. Like, they have a pretty tough bracket. It's going to get pretty sloppy in there. I think the South is really good. Houston, Duke, Kentucky, and Marquette all in one side of the bracket. I think the weakest division is probably the Midwest. Purdue's the number one seed there. I cannot trust them. I will not trust them. I will never trust them. They will lose again. Kansas is a number four seed. I'm not thrilled with Kansas this year. They've been pretty inconsistent, in my opinion. I really like Creighton. Tennessee's the number two seed. They lost pretty poorly in the SEC champion or in the SEC tournament, I should say. I think the South is definitely the toughest to come out of. And I think Kentucky's going to get there. So based on, this is what I mentioned about KenPom, historical trends, top six in KenPom, top around 20-ish in offense and defense. The teams that qualify, UConn, Houston, Purdue, Auburn, and Arizona. So I'm going loosely based on that. I think Kentucky is a great offensive team. And for someone like that roster with John Calipari and the ability they have to go on runs, I think in March, all it takes is one hot streak. And I think Kentucky's very much capable of that. I think all of these teams are capable of that. UConn and North Carolina, I think flat out, are just like the best overall teams. But Kentucky and Creighton, I mean, Creighton beat UConn this season. Creighton's very good. And I like Kentucky a lot. I think this could be the year Calipari gets back on top. This could be the year Calipari gets back on top. And people are, you know, they're whispers. There are whispers about if he's going to continue to be Kentucky's coach. They haven't gotten to a Final Four in a long time. Since 2015, 9 years ago was the last time they made a Final Four. However, you know, they do make the Elite Eight quite a bit. They made it back in 2019 was the last time they made the Elite Eight. So for Kentucky, I think this could be a run that they could really go on. At least that's my gut opinion right now. Like I said, I'll probably tinker with this a bit. I'm pretty comfortable picking Kentucky as a champion, though. A lot of people obviously are going to be picking UNC. A lot of people are going to be picking UConn. I love UNC. UNC is usually a team that I really root for when it comes to March Madness, but I think I'm going to go Kentucky this year. I think I am. So that's what I got. Again, let's see. My Sweet 16 is UConn, San Diego State, Illinois, Washington State in the East, and then in the West, I have North Carolina versus Alabama and Baylor versus Arizona. In the South, I have Houston versus Duke, Kentucky versus Marquette. And in the Midwest, I have TCU versus Kansas and Creighton versus Tennessee. My Elite Eight is UConn versus Illinois. In the East, in the West, it's North Carolina versus Arizona. In the South, it's Duke, Kentucky. And in the Midwest, it's TCU, Creighton. And again, once again, in my Final Four, I have UConn versus North Carolina and Kentucky versus Creighton. And I have North Carolina versus Kentucky in the championship game with Kentucky winning it all. And a final score tiebreaker of 153. That is my full first bracket. That's raw. That's a raw bracket. I just did it before I started recording. So that's my raw first picks in the bracket. So don't get on me for that. But yeah, that is my March Madness bracket. Always a great time of the year. It's the best weekend, arguably the best weekend in sports, because it airs college basketball all day, 12 hours a day for like three straight days. It is awesome. So, or four straight days. I think it's what, Thursday to Sunday, right? Not Thursday to Saturday. So that is our March Madness preview. Just a little something. Obviously, next week on Monday, after the first weekend of the tournament, we're going to be able to discuss all the different upsets, which I'm sure there will be multiple of, and give like a small update on the bracket. All right, on to baseball. Opening day, just 10 days away. March 28th is the first day of the season. Very, very exciting. Recently, I wrote an article for AnimalHouseUSA.com. You can go and read it on there. Season preview and predictions for all 30 MLB teams. We're going to get right into it. We're going to start with the AL West and move all the way down to the NL West in the end. So the AL East, going in order of how I think these teams will finish. The Baltimore Orioles, 104-58. They're young. They're very talented. They went over 100 games last year. Jackson Holliday is going to be the starting shortstop, and I just think that gives them a huge boost. He is a stud. He's been raking in spring training. The kid's going to be really good, man. The kid is going to be really good. And on top of all of that, they got pitching, which I think was what really did them in last year. I'm not really sure anything would have helped them against the Texas Rangers, because the Rangers were just on such a heater when they got into the playoffs and on a complete, they went on a bender, honestly. Like they, it didn't matter who was on the mound, they were going to hit you. So kind of, you know, you're doing the whole going up against an unstoppable object kind of thing. So, but the Orioles did trade for Corbin Burnes, and they got Craig Kimbrell as well. So two huge additions to their starting rotation and their bullpen. I think that will pay a lot of dividends. And then, of course, you have Adley Rutschman, Gunnar Henderson, year two Gunnar Henderson, and Jackson Holliday is going to be your starting shortstop. Very, 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 very exciting stuff for the Baltimore Orioles going ahead. The Yankees finishing second at 92-70. These are my original thoughts. This was written before Gerrit Cole. I will not be changing my prediction based on that. It's already published. So, injuries happen. Gerrit Cole, he's out 1 to 2 months. Let's talk about it. Not much to discuss, actually. He had an injury to his throwing elbow. Soreness that he couldn't really shake. Very alarming. Obviously, the first signs you point to there is Tommy John surgery. Torn UCL. He went to two different experts, got two different opinions. They both said he didn't tear anything. The MRIs came back clean. He does have, I think it's like an inflamed tendon in his elbow, which explains the soreness. So he will be shut down and reevaluated in 1 to 2 months. However, the good news is that he avoided Tommy John surgery. The bad news, if we're talking in hypotheticals, the bad news is he could easily come back, pitch a handful of games, and then hurt his elbow again, get Tommy John, and be shut down for the rest of the year. That would be a nightmare. I'm really hoping that doesn't happen, but it would be a nightmare. Now, do the Yankees compensate? Blake Snell and Jordan Montgomery are still unsigned. Opening day is 10 days away. Nelson Cortez was named the opening day starter for the Yankees. So how do they approach it? They need somebody. They can't just go into this season without Gerrit Cole and a backup plan. It's just not going to work. Last year, everyone except Gerrit Cole got injured, and he shouldered the load. He won an AL Cy Young. It still wasn't enough. The Yankees sucked. So how can they help? They need, if the only way it works is if Carlos Rodon returns to his form that he had with the Giants, and he is a true blue number one starter. It's the only way the Yankees make it out of this without Gerrit Cole the first 2 months of the season. Otherwise, it's going to be a nightmare. So, do they sign Blake Snell? I don't know. There have been rumors, of course, that they are interested in Blake Snell. Juan Soto has mentioned that he would endorse the signing of Blake Snell, obviously his former Padres teammate. It's a very delicate situation right now with the Yankees pitching staff, because Gerrit Cole is the man there. And if he's not pitching for 1 to 2 months, like, you know, what do you do? Literally, what do you do? I'm not sure. So it's going to be interesting to see how the Yankees kind of plug that hole. And it's a real big hole. And Stroman, like, it's not that you have bad pitchers. It's just that Gerrit Cole is basically irreplaceable. So what do you do? You know, you're relying on Stroman, who's been injured. You're relying on Rodon, who's been injured. And even when he pitched last year, he was horrible. Nelson Cortez, good. Again, last year, injured. So you're relying on everyone to be healthy for the first 2 months of the season and pitch well enough to keep your team above, you know, your head's under above water. Gerrit Cole's a big loss. Could have been worse, though. It could have been worse. So I'm hoping in 1 to 2 months, comes back, pitches, he rehabs, he's all good, and he pitches the rest of the season with no problems. That's what I'm hoping. The Tampa Bay Rays in third place. I think this is finally the year they take a step back. 86 and 76 is my prediction. McClanahan is out with Tommy John surgery. They got rid of Tyler Glasnow, who really hasn't been a part of the team for like the last year and a half. He pitched last year, he came back, but even so, they were able to live without him, mostly because of Shane McClanahan. But he's out with Tommy John. Glasnow is now a Dodger. They lost Manuel Margot. And they just, again, Wander Franco is a pedophile, so he's out. It's just, they lost a lot of players. And in typical Rays fashion, their MO has always been get rid of guys a year early instead of a year late. That's always been their MO, and it's worked for like the past 6 or 7 years. And for the past 6 or 7 years, they've been in the bottom, or really the past, like I should say the past 5 years, we'll say. Not 6 or 7. 6 or 7 is a bit long. Past 5 years. The Rays have been bottom 5 in the league in payroll and top of the league in the standings. Kevin Cash works his magic. That's just how it is. So it could be another one of those years where the Rays just, despite getting rid of some of their more premier talent, they supplement it with younger, cheaper talent that works, and Kevin Cash has them back in the playoffs. It's very, very possible. But to me, they won 99 games last year. I just don't see that happening with the current injuries that they have and the loss of productivity that they had. I just don't see that happening. I have them about 13 wins less this year at 86 and 76 and right in the middle of the AL East. The Toronto Blue Jays. Blue Jays lost out on the Ohtani sweepstakes after all the rumors and stuff. They finished last year 89 and 73. I have them right at 500 this year, 81 and 81. I think that they lost a lot of players. They lost Matt Chapman, Hyunjin Ryu, Whit Merrifield, Jordan Hicks. And they brought in Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, a 40-year-old Justin Turner, and Kevin Kiermaier. Not really a great balance of in and out for the Toronto Blue Jays. They just have not been able to make it work. It's something every year. It's like something just doesn't click. Last year, it was a down year for Vlad Guerrero Jr. at the plate. Alejandro Kirk, down year for him at the plate as well. Whereas in 2022, they were both all-stars. 2023, they weren't really that good. So you're asking a huge, huge step up from them. Another step up from Bo Bichette, who was just on fire for the first, I think, like 3 or 4 months of the season. Kind of cooled down a little bit, but still had like, I think, 315 average, something like that. He was a beast. Bo Bichette was good. And not to say Vlad Guerrero was bad, but he certainly didn't put up the numbers that people expected him to put up. So for me, for the Blue Jays, it kind of just feels like more of the same. You're relying on the same guys to give you more than what they've shown they're capable of. And it's not going to work. I think the loss of some of these players is just not going to be enough for them to overcome. And I think they're going to sink back down to about a 500 team and miss the playoffs again. And if I'm right, I think the following offseason, in a year from now, we're going to be looking at a much different Blue Jays team. In dead last, I have the Boston Red Sox. I was generous here. I have them at 70 and 92. They finished 78 and 84 last year. I have them at 70 and 92 this season. They could very well be a 100-plus loss team. Chris Sale has been banged up for them, unfortunately. The entire team really has just had nothing but bad luck when it comes to injuries. They let Xander Bogaerts walk for nothing in free agency. They have some young talent, but generally injuries just completely have riddled them for the past 3 years. Chris Sale's gone now. You signed Lucas Giolito as like your kind of bigger move to bolster your pitching staff. That's just been absolutely dreadful for the past few seasons. And now Lucas Giolito is in trouble of, he might miss the season. He's in jeopardy of missing the entire season, which would just obviously be a nightmare for the Red Sox. But generally speaking, this team's not ready to compete. I don't think this team expects to compete. So me having them in dead last, hovering around 100 losses, is not really something that should surprise a lot of people. The AL Central. The Detroit Tigers. I have them winning the AL Central. They finished pretty hot last year, ended 78-84. I think the AL Central is probably the worst division in baseball, so I think it's wide open for anyone to win. I have the Tigers winning it at 87-75. Miguel Cabrera, future first ballot Hall of Famer, has officially retired. It is a new regime in Detroit. They're going to have their young guys that need to take a little bit of a step up and remain healthy the entire year. Spencer Torkelson, Riley Green, Kerry Carpenter, Matt Manning, Casey Mize. Guys in the field, guys on the mound. You need all of them to excel. You need your young bucks to take a step up, and I think they're going to do it. If they're healthy, they're going to be good, and I think you're going to see the Tigers finally resurrect themselves. Maybe it's the year of Detroit. You know, the Pistons are flat out horrible, but the Red Wings seem to be getting it together. The Lions were obviously spectacular this year. I think the Tigers are going to join them. They're going to be able to right the ship, get better. I think last year was a huge step. Javier Baez is a huge, huge, huge stain on all of this because you're paying him $25 million a year to hit 200. He's the biggest problem. He might actually be holding the Tigers back, which pains me to say because I love Javi. He's been one of my favorite players to watch for years, but his productivity has been absolutely in the toilet since he signed with Detroit, really. So it's a problem. But on top of the young bucks, they get Kenta Maeda from the division rival Twins, who he has been banged up. So ideally, Kenta Maeda, health is always a huge concern with a lot of these teams. Kenta Maeda, Jack Flaherty, and Andrew Chafin, and Mark Canha. So you got a nice mix of pitchers, veteran pitchers in there, in the bullpen, starting rotation. Mark Canha has been a good veteran for the past like 3 years. I think he's going to prove that his worth there for Detroit as well. I like what Detroit has going on. In second place, the Kansas City Royals. I'm expecting a huge flip in this division this year. The bottom teams are now at the top. Kansas City, they have spent more this offseason than they have in years. And I think it's a direct indication that they are ready to play winning baseball again. And I'm very excited for it. They signed Seth Lugo, Michael Wacha, Will Smith, Hunter Renfro, and Adam Frazier. So you're bolstering your rotation and your bullpen and also veterans in the field. I really like what they did here. Again, I think they're spending in free agency and early spending, by the way. Free agency started and the Royals were the first team to sign a couple of guys and to really make some moves. So I think that is a direct indication that they are ready to win and try and compete in the AL Central again. Especially with Bobby Witt. I think Bobby Witt Jr. is the biggest part of that. Sign him to a massive deal. And now it's like, this is our guy, is Bobby Witt. And he's going to lead us into the future. We need to build a team around him and we need to do it now. And they are taking action. I love it. Minnesota in third place. I don't like the Twins. I've never liked the Twins. I think they were just a product of being in a bad division. I never thought they were actually a good baseball team. And that proves just by like how they perform in the playoffs. That's just how it is for Minnesota. I'm sorry, Twins fans. It's just the way it is. But you lose Sonny Gray. You lose Kenta Maeda. You trade Jorge Polanco to the Seattle Mariners. You're basically relying your entire season on Byron Buxton, Carlos Correa, and Royce Lewis, all of which have injury history. Carlos Correa, from last offseason, we learned his knee is about to fall off in just not a matter of if, but when kind of deal, which is not great, obviously. Byron Buxton has never been able to stay healthy despite his immense talent, never been able to stay healthy. I don't even know if he's ever played over 150 games. Just off the top of my head, I'm going to assume no. Royce Lewis. Injury history as well. despite all the grand slams he hits last year. He does have an injury history. So you're relying on three guys to basically carry the load. I don't see how after trading and losing some of these trading people and losing some guys in free agency, I just don't see how the Twins are going to stay afloat in the AL Central. Even though it's a bad division, I don't see them competing this year. The Guardians, kind of the same thing. You have Shane Bieber and Tristan McKenzie. McKenzie was injured all of last year. You have two guys that if they're healthy, two of the better top two guys in any rotation in baseball, quite honestly, Shane Bieber and Tristan McKenzie. They're both, I love McKenzie, dude. I want him in pinstripes. Like he's a guy that you look at and you're like, God, he's got great stuff, man. He really is so tall and long. And it's just, by the time he releases, he's one of those guys that when the ball is released, it's halfway to the plate already. So McKenzie's really nice, but they have no offense. And that's the way it's been for a couple of years now. The Guardians just have no offense. And they were 76 and 86 last year. I have them at 70 and 92 this year. I just don't see that. I don't see it happening for them. I wouldn't be surprised if Jose Ramirez gets traded in like some type of mega deal at the deadline this year. I don't really expect him to, because he is just like a super loyal person and he loves Cleveland and he loves the fans and he loves being there. So I don't really think he's going to get traded, but if he did, it would make a lot of sense considering how I think this season is going to go for them. And then on top of that, you have like Jose Ramirez and the Naylor brothers being Andrés Giménez too. He had a big down year last year compared to his 2022 campaign, which was spectacular. He was one of the best second basemen in baseball that year. But last year, not nearly as good. So you're expecting some bounce back from people. But they have a lot of young players and just guys that I'm the consistency is the issue there in Cleveland. In dead last, the Chicago White Sox. This should not come to a surprise from anybody. They were dreadful last year, 101 losses. I have them even worse this year. I have them 55 and 107. They're not going to be good. Luis Robert Jr. is the only one of note on that team. Tim Anderson's gone. They just traded Dylan Cease, which when I wrote this, he hadn't been traded yet. And right before it was published, he was traded to the San Diego Padres. So that just makes everything worse for Chicago. You have one less great player there. It's just going to be, it's going to be hell. And the White Sox, it's really sad what one bad managerial hire can do. It really is, because they made the playoffs. I think they played their wild card series against the Oakland A's and they lost a wild card game against the Oakland A's and they lost. You really thought sky's the limit. Right? They got, Yan Moncada, Eloy Jimenez, Luis Robert Jr., Tim Anderson. This is the future. They're going to be all right. Dylan Cease, like, things are going to be okay. One bad managerial decision, Tony La Russa. One bad, destroyed Yermin Mercedes, destroyed his career and his confidence. He's not even the majors anymore. And he was like a bright catcher that people kind of were like, oh, maybe he's got something, right? Like he got off to a hot start to his major's career. Nope. Tony La Russa completely destroyed him by yelling at him for swinging at a 3-0 pitch to hit a home run against the Twins. Like the most obnoxious stuff you could think of. Tony La Russa was a coach that hadn't coached in like 10 years, old as hell, coming into a situation where he's got a young, vibrant team with a lot of personalities and guys who like to express themselves on the baseball field, and is just the complete antithesis of that. It's just bad, 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 bad decision. And it has set the way, it has completely, completely destroyed the foundation of the Chicago White Sox, and they are right back into the gutter, and it's very sad. The AL West, we got the Houston Astros at number one. I have the AL West, the top three teams, very, very, very tight. This might be unpopular, but it is what it is. You have the Houston Astros up top at 88 and 74. Last year, they finished 90 and 72. Michael Brantley retires. They have Josh Hader. they're still the Houston Astros. They still have Bregman, Kyle Tucker, Yordan Alvarez, Jose Altuve. Like, they still have a great core. Justin Verlander's still their ace. Until further notice, the Astros are going to be the team to beat in that division. I don't care that the Texas Rangers won the World Series, literally won the World Series last year. The Astros are the Kansas City Chiefs of the MLB. They've been to 7 straight ALCSs, 4 World Series. Like, they are the team to beat. In second place, I have the Seattle Mariners. I think they finally get over the hump. They got kind of screwed last year. They got the short end of the stick, as you know, it has to happen to somebody. And unfortunately, it was the Mariners. But I think they really have some moves here that can catapult them to the top. I have them again, a couple wins less than last year, 88-74 to 86-76. Ideally, they have more than that. I'm really pulling for them. I like the addition of Jorge Polanco. They have the Mitches, Garver, and Haniger that they signed. They lose Teoscar Hernandez, Jared Kelenic, Eugenio Suarez, but I think this is the year that they could finally maybe get over that hump, make it back to the playoffs, make a run. The Rangers, I have in third place. At 85-77, I just think Tyler Mahle, they signed. He's recovering from Tommy John. Jacob DeGrom's recovering from Tommy John. Max Scherzer is recovering from surgery as well. 3 starting pitchers all out. Yes, they did lose Jordan Montgomery. He's unsigned currently. So, yeah, they kind of rebounded from some of the injuries last year. Max Scherzer came back for a playoff push to kind of help a little bit. But for a few months here, at the bare minimum, you're going to be out without 3 of those guys. It's going to be tough. If their pitching can hold up, I think they'll be fine. But I think it's certainly possible they get off to a slow enough start where they're just not able to recover in a very good division with 2 other good teams. That's just how I feel about the Texas Rangers. I hate counting them out. I hate putting them where they are because they just won the World Series. But yeah, I have them at 85-75, which is 5 less wins than they had last year. And I have them in third place. Again, I have them 1 game behind Seattle and 3 games behind Houston. That's how I think this division is going to shape up. It's going to be less than 5 games separating the 3 teams from the top. That's how I feel. And in a stark contrast, the bottom teams, the Angels and the Athletics, I think will be 2 of the worst teams in the league. The Angels finished 73-89 last year. That was with Shohei Ohtani. They're going to finish 58-104 this year. I'm predicting 100-plus losses for the Los Angeles Angels. It doesn't matter if Anthony Rendon plays 162 games. It will not matter. The Angels are bad. You don't just lose a top 3 player in all of baseball and suddenly get better. It's not going to happen. So prepare yourselves, Angels fans. I also think this is a real possibility, despite Mike Trout saying that asking for a trade would be the easy way out. I really do think that if there's going to be a year where he gets traded, it's this year. I think it's this year. If he's healthy and playing well and the Angels are just losing games because they're bad, I think Mike Trout might finally break, or the Angels might break. I don't know. Either way, I think he could get traded this year. I really do think that. It would just be such a sin to have this guy waste his career for the Angels. Like, send him somewhere, man. Literally anywhere. Literally any team that's halfway competent and has a playoff shot or a real playoff opportunity, send him there. Doesn't matter where the market is. Doesn't matter who else is on the team. Just send him somewhere, dude. Please. This can't be allowed. He's so good, and he has 1 playoff appearance. It's impossible, dude. You can't. It's a stain on the MLB. It really is. In dead last, the Oakland Athletics. I have them a couple wins better this year, but last year they were 50-112. This year they're 53-109. They're basically just playing hot potato until they get to move to Las Vegas, which I don't even think Vegas wants them. But they're playing hot potato until they can get to Vegas, and they're fielding a minor league team for a second year in a row. They're going to be unwatchable. They're not going to be fun. The city doesn't deserve it. The fans don't deserve it. Yet this is what it is. And it's all because of one person. The NL East. Into the National League we go. We're almost done here. NL East. Atlanta Braves. They were 104-58 last year. I have them at 101-81 this year. If Chris Sale is healthy. What a pull that would be for the Atlanta Braves. Once again, the rich get richer if he's healthy, which obviously he hasn't been able to stay healthy. So again, big if, but you lose Eddie Rosario, Kyle Wright, Michael Soroka, but you sign Jared Kelenic and you get Chris Sale. So not a bad offseason for the Braves. Obviously, there's only a certain amount of moves a team like this can make because they have all of their star players locked up for the foreseeable future. Matt Olson, Ozzie Albies, Acuna, Austin Riley, all these Michael Harris, all these guys that are the core of this team, they're all locked up for the foreseeable future. So again, supplemental moves. You know, you're only trying to support these guys and slightly enhance your roster. You're not trying to remake your team. You're not trying to make a big splash because you have all of the best players or you have a lot of the best players at each position, honestly. Like, they really, really do. So for the Braves, still two really good moves. Like, Kelenic is going to be a solid corner outfielder, occasionally play center field to give Harris a rest if he wants. But Kelenic will be a corner outfielder, probably their left fielder because they lost Rosario. So it'll be Kelenic, Harris, unless I'm forgetting someone, which I don't think I am. It'll be Kelenic, Harris, Acuna in the outfield. So, and then Chris Sale, like I said, if he's healthy, that's a nasty addition to that rotation. The Phillies finishing in second place yet again, but they'll probably beat the Braves in the playoffs because that's what they do. They were 90-72 last year. They're 94-68. My prediction for 2024. Rhys Hoskins is gone. So Bryce Harper got a back issue he has to monitor, but he will be the everyday first baseman for them, which is kind of sad. I like Bryce Harper in the outfield, but I think that back is definitely going to, I think that's going to really hinder him. So playing first base is definitely the smart move. Two big things that Philly did this year. Re-sign Aaron Nola and extend Zach Wheeler. So they re-signed Aaron Nola to a 7-year, $170 million contract, and they extended Zach Wheeler for a 3-year, $120 million contract. It's the most money in a contract extension, I think in terms of AAV, it was for Zach Wheeler in the history of baseball. in terms of AAV for an extension, $120 million through 3 years for Zach Wheeler. The Phillies will be really good. They'll be back in the playoffs, and they'll probably beat the Braves again. This is the way. It is written. Got the Mets in third place, unfortunately. I do think they finished better this season, shockingly, which I feel like is maybe a stretch. They could be significantly worse, to be honest with you. But a lot of guys, you know, Marte couldn't really stay healthy. Jeff McNeil had a down year. So I think McNeil and Marte can bounce back and bring some much-needed production to the lineup outside of Francisco Lindor and Pete Alonso. The rotation is obviously the biggest thing. You sign Sean Manea, who, when he's healthy, you know exactly what you're getting. And then Luis Severino is a huge question mark because he's coming off. He was a guy that was contending for an AL Cy Young a few short years ago, and he also has an injury history, but last year he was healthy and was just abysmal, like flat out the worst year of his career. He knew it. Boone knew it. The Yankees fans knew it. Everyone knew it. And it was sad to see. So you're hoping he has a bounce back year with the Mets. I'm hoping he has a bounce back year with the Mets. And then Kodai Senga on the IL to start the year is not great, obviously. And then on top of all of that, you have the ever-looming Pete Alonso contract extension that is probably not going to happen throughout the course of this year. Talks have been tabled. They're not going to be, or negotiations have been tabled. They're not going to be discussed throughout the rest of the year. So unfortunately for Mets fans, as the season weighs on, you're going to have to start thinking about that. Like, oh my God. Kind of like the Aaron Judge situation, really. Like, there's a real chance he walks for nothing and we lose one of the best players in baseball. So I hope for Mets fans' sakes that doesn't happen. Steve Cohen, I understand he's like trying to rebuild the team now because he went all in. It didn't work. He recognized that. Traded away Scherzer, Verlander, all that. Didn't work. Kind of revamping. You need Brett Beatty to show something. You need Mark Vientos to show something. You need these young guys to show something, that there's a future. You need to show. Ronnie Mauricio, unfortunately, he injured his knee, so I don't think he's going to be playing this season. Or maybe, you know, it'll be some type of longer recovery time for him. But that sucks for the Mets. Like, you're not going to be able to see. He was a bright spot. So really, it's Vientos and Beatty got to show something, because I think Mauricio is really one of the key guys, one of the real bright spots for the Mets in the future here. In fourth place, I have the Miami Marlins. Unfortunately for the Marlins, who finished 84-78 last year, they are now 73-89 in 2024 is my prediction. That really has to do with Sandy Alcantara. He's out for the entire year with Tommy John surgery. This guy was a workhorse for them. He was an innings eater. He was a bullpen saver. He went complete game after complete game, chewed up innings, won a lot of games for the Marlins basically by himself. 1-0 games, 2-0 games, you know, just shutting down the opponent. One of the best pitchers, top five pitcher in the entire league. NL Cy Young Award winner a couple years ago. He is a beast, and they're going to be without him the entire year. And on top of that, I mean, they signed Tim Anderson, but they lose Jorge Soler, who had like 30 home runs, I think, last year. 90-plus RBIs. Like, the production that Soler brought to the plate is something that I don't really think the Marlins did a very good job of replacing. And I think they're going to feel that offensively, because they essentially have the same roster minus Soler and Alcantara because he's injured. So I don't think it's going to work out for the Marlins, unfortunately. But clearly there's an ownership problem and a sense of direction down there in Miami that's just not being appreciated, because Jeter left. He wasn't allowed to spend money. Kim Ng left as well, and she was doing great. The Marlins, this is the same thing that happened with Derek Jeter. Derek Jeter traded everybody away. He tried to build a team. They made the playoffs in 2020. They made the wild card round in 2020. And then the next year, he was like, I want to sign Castellanos. And they were like, no. So he left. And he gave the reins to Kim Ng, who is, she was the first female general manager in MLB history. She did a great job building this team. They made the playoffs again after finishing with 80 plus wins. And then the next year, and she leaves. After the season, she leaves. Why is that? Because she's not allowed to actually build a team. As soon as they get good and it's like, all right, now it's time to like build more in free agency. We got our young players. We know who we're keeping. Let's build in free agency. And everyone says, no, you're not allowed to spend money. How is that fair? And it's Kim Ng, not Kim Ng, unfortunately. Sorry, I got my pronunciation wrong. It's just Kim Ng. So I thought it was Ng. There was like a extra I and N in there, but it's Kim Ng. So my apologies. But Kim Ng left for the same reasons as Derek Jeter. She wasn't allowed to spend money. And not only that, so this is from the LA Times back in October. So Ng, not to get into a whole thing about the Marlins here, but Ng already knew Sherman, the owner of the Marlins, was frugal, with the Marlins ranking 26th, 28th, and 23rd in payroll during her three seasons as GM. She already knew the franchise has a reputation as dysfunctional, with Derek Jeter stepping down as chief executive a year ago, saying the direction of the organization was, quote, not what I signed up for. Two people with knowledge of Ng's thinking said she wouldn't walk away from her post as the first female general manager in North American sports unless another opportunity beckons her, or her relationship with Sherman had developed irreconcilable differences. Sherman wanting to add an executive whom Ng would report to certainly would qualify. So not only did she build this team up and get them back into the playoffs, the owner wanted to hire someone that she would have to report to because he wanted to save money because he didn't want to spend. That's what happens, man. It's bad. It's bad down there in Miami. And I think they're going to lose again now because she's not helming the ship. She's not building this team anymore. They didn't spend anything on anyone. They let Soler walk. Like, they're bad. They're going to be bad again. In dead last for the NL East, the Washington Nationals, they will finish 67-95. The one bright spot here, Dylan Cruz and James Wood. They're both going to be good, I think. They're both going to be outfielders. They're both going to be good. And I think they should end up getting some significant playing time this year at the major league level. So that's a bright spot for Washington Nationals fans. The NL Central, in first place, I have the Cubbies. So the Cubs, a historic collapse last year to miss out on the playoffs. They re-signed Cody Bellinger. I think they're back. Justin Steele's their guy on the mound. They re-signed Bellinger. They got Craig Counsell. They coached him from the division rival Brewers, where Counsell is probably literally Benedict Arnold slash Judas kind of level for that franchise, that city, that team. But they have him now manning the ship for Chicago. And I think the Cubs are going to continue to play good baseball, and they're going to win an NL Central that's pretty open. In second place, I have the Reds. The Reds certainly made a huge step. They signed Frankie Montes, who, you know, has injury history. Maybe if he's healthy, he contributes to them in a less high stakes environment, because God knows he was trash for the Yankees. But they improved by 20 wins from last year to this year, from 2022 to 2023. They improved by 20 wins. That's a lot. Now, I'm not expecting to make another huge leap, but certainly a better leap is in order. 82 and 80 to 87 and 75 is what I have them at. Joey Votto's gone. Officially a new era of Cincinnati Reds baseball. I love Ellie De La Cruz. Encarnacion Strand is a good young player. Like, they got pieces, and I think the Reds can continue to improve this year. In third place, I have the Pirates. Now, personally, 2025, I think the Pirates are going to win the NL Central. I think they're just a year too soon here. You have O'Neill Cruz is going to be healthy, knock on wood, after being injured last year. I think this was the first time last year that they cracked 70 wins for the first time since 2018. Pretty crazy to think about. But you have O'Neill Cruz. Tamar Johnson is 19 years old and an absolute stud of a second baseman. I don't think maybe he'll be like a September call-up, but I wouldn't expect anything earlier than that for him. But he's going to be really good. And, you know, next year you're looking at Key Brian Hayes, O'Neill Cruz, and Tamar Johnson as your starting infield, which is really, really exciting. I still think they need to improve their pitching more in order to really compete. But offensively speaking, I think the Pirates are going to be a lot of fun to watch this year. And I have them finishing third. So fourth, I have the Cardinals. The Cardinals are just old. They are old and decrepit. I mean, they signed Lance Lynn, Sonny Gray, Kyle Gibson, and Brandon Crawford. Crawford's 37, I think, maybe even 38. Lynn and Gibson are 36, and Sonny Gray's 34. Paul Goldschmidt's 36 years old. Nolan Arenado's in his early 30s. The Cardinals have no youth. They have Mason Winn, and they have Jordan Walker. That's it. And those are two young guys that you can't be expected to shoulder the load of this team. So I think just like this old age, and the pitching was really the problem for St. Louis last year. And they went out and they signed pitchers, but all of them are old and might not be able to be like, they're not going to be guys that can go the entire length of the season and make deep playoff runs. So I think it's just going to be more of the same for St. Louis this year, unfortunately. Goldschmidt had a huge down year after winning an MVP. Nolan Arenado was an all-star last year, but it was by far the worst year he had as a pro. I don't like what St. Louis did at all. I think they're grasping at straws to stay afloat, and it's all going to come crumbling down. They'll probably have to trade one of Arenado or Goldschmidt by the trade deadline if things are still going poorly. I have them at 75 and 87 after they finished 71 and 91 last year. So I have them slightly improved because they did improve their pitching, but everyone is older and I just don't know if that's going to hold up. So I think the Cardinals are still going to be bad. Shockingly in last place, I have the Milwaukee Brewers, who won the division two of the past three seasons. They just lost a lot of players. I mean, Woodruff, it might not pitch this year. Corbin Burns got traded. You have Jackson Churio is this young stud of an outfielder that's going to come in and hopefully enter this new regime. You got stabbed in the back by Craig Counsell. So I think it's just going to be bad vibes from Milwaukee this year. I think it's going to be a lot of problems, a lot of dysfunctionality. And I just don't think they have any pitching to really replace someone like Corbin Burns. I don't. So it's going to be rough in Milwaukee. I have them at 72-90, almost a complete opposite of what they were last year at 92-70. Almost the complete opposite. Yeah, I don't think it's going to be a good year for Milwaukee, unfortunately. Could be wrong. I could be wrong on a lot of these, but this is just where my head's at. The last division in baseball, the NL West. Number one, absolutely no surprise here, the Los Angeles Dodgers. They finished 162 last year, and that was with all of their injuries. This year, I have them at 111-51. I think they're going to be, by the time September rolls around next year, we're going to be looking at the Dodgers, and if they remain healthy and everyone's moving, we could look at them and be like, could they break the all-time single-season wins record this year? Could they do it? I think it's going to be a real possibility. Obviously, they signed Shohei Ohtani to a mega deal where he deferred all the money, so they were still able to sign a bunch of other people, including his fellow countryman, Yoshinobu Yamamoto. Yoshi, he is going to be a huge addition to that rotation. Tyler Glasnow, if he can stay healthy, nasty. So now you got Walker Buehler. Shohei's not even going to pitch this year, so it doesn't even really matter. But next year, he's going to be pitching. So you have Yamamoto, Glasnow, Walker Buehler. They signed James Paxton. And Buehler, he's not going to start the regular season, according to Dave Roberts, but he should return to them relatively soon, I think. And then you have Gonsolin. Dustin May is hopefully going to be back this season. Bobby Miller, like, they have a lot of guys. And again, injuries happened a lot. Dustin May, Walker Buehler, big-time injuries for them. So if everyone's healthy, I don't see how they don't win 110-plus games, to be honest with you. Manuel Margot is a good addition in the outfield as well. They are loaded, literally loaded. In second place, the San Diego Padres. Very, very talented team last year. Their record was not a proper reflection of just how good a lot of the players on the Dodgers, on the Padres were last year. They lost Blake Snell, but they gained Dylan Cease. They lost Juan Soto, but they got a pretty good haul for him from the Yankees. Michael King's probably going to be a guy that he was working towards the starting rotation for the Yankees last year and looking pretty good. So I don't know if the Padres plan to use him in the rotation or in the bullpen, but either way, I think he's a good pitcher. Johnny Brito is young. Give him a spin, maybe. And then, of course, like I said, they also signed Wandy Peralta, which I think is a great signing for bullpen-wise because they lost Josh Hader. Dylan Cease, also great, obviously. Mentioned him. And it's just going to be more of Bogarts and Machado leading the way. And this is so funny because everyone, but all but two, I think so, seven of the nine, or I should say six of the eight, not including the pitcher, six of the eight starters are former shortstops. So Xander Bogaerts is going to be their second baseman now. I have no idea why this move was made, but they're moving him from short to second base. Kim, who was their second baseman last year, they switched them. I don't know why. But Bogaerts is at second base, former shortstop. Tatis in right field, former shortstop. Cronenworth at first base, former shortstop. Machado at third base, former shortstop. Kim at shortstop, the current shortstop. And then Profar in left field is a former shortstop. And Merrill in center field is a former shortstop. Insane. Absolutely insanity. That's so funny that. And then Tyler Wade is also on the team as a utility man. Will be playing all around. He's also a former shortstop. So they're just collecting shortstops and putting them all over the field. It's pretty funny. But the Padres, I think they'll be all right. I think they'll have a much better year than they did last year. The Arizona Diamondbacks, they made the World Series, magical run for them. They got hot. They were hot for, I think, the first 3 months of the year. They were on a tear. I think they had, it was July. I think things just fell apart for them in July where they were horrible. And then they had to kind of scratch their way into the playoffs, but they went on a heater in the playoffs. I don't think they lost a game until they played the Phillies in the NLCS. So it was pretty insane. A pretty insane run for the Arizona Diamondbacks. And do I think they can get back to the World Series? Probably not, unfortunately. They're still a young team. They get Eugenio Suarez, Eduardo Rodriguez, and Jock Peterson into the mix. Definitely helps. But I think they're in a tough division with the Dodgers and Padres that they're going to be chipping away with. And I'm just not sure they're like the Seattle Mariners of the National League at this point, you know, like teams that are capable of going on runs, but I'm just not sure given the competition around them. I think they just get the short end of the stick, you know, where I did have the Mariners squeaking in there this year I predicted them to squeak in this year, but for the Diamondbacks, I'm not sure if it's going to be something that is repeatable. I do have them winning more games though. It's just that I have the Padres not being as bad as they were last year. That's what really helped the Diamondbacks a lot, is that the Padres were a 500 team last year. And this year I have them at like around 90 wins. Last year, the Diamondbacks, did I mention that? The Padres, 90 and 72, I have them at. For the Diamondbacks, I have them at 88 and 74. Last year, they were 84 and 78. So that's my prediction for the Diamondbacks. The San Francisco Giants, I actually like what the Giants did this year. They got Jung Ho Lee. They got Robbie Ray, who's going to start the year on the IL. They have Jorge Soler, who they signed, which I really like. Alex Cobb also starting the year on the IL. So, they're really going to be relying on Logan Webb again. For like the third year in a row, they're going to be relying heavily on Logan Webb as their main guy. I think the Giants could be good, though. If they get healthy, if they stay afloat and they get healthy at the right time, they could make a run. We've seen them really overperform before, and I think they can overperform again. I think they can really be competitive in a tough division. They were 79 and 83 last year. I have them at 86 and 76 this year. And the last team, fitting, that I have the least to say about them, the Colorado Rockies. They suck. They have absolutely no sense of the direction. They're the punching bag of the National League. They are basically the Oakland A's. No sense of direction. I'm pretty sure they only signed Chris Bryant so they can just be like, hey, look, we have Chris Bryant. Put some fans in the seats, you know? Because trading Nolan Arenado and then signing Chris Bryant that same offseason, trading Nolan Arenado during the season and then signing Chris Bryant that offseason, to this day, I cannot wrap my head around that move. They're really bad, and they're going to continue to be really bad. They were 59 and 103 last year. I have them at 55 and 107 this season. They're going to be bad. They're going to be really, really bad. I have them as the second worst team in the entire league behind the Oakland A's. So that is my long MLB preview. The 2024 season is right around the corner. I'm very excited. I wanted to get this out before March Madness because I didn't want to have to do it next week because I think the first game's the 28th. So I didn't want to have to do it next week when we're recapping March Madness and all this other stuff. I thought it'd be better now when it's a little bit lighter on the schedule. So there's the 2024 MLB predictions. Surely none of those will age poorly, and no team that I picked to be bad is good, and no team that I picked to be good is bad. Surely that won't happen. No shot. 100% accurate 2024 predictions. That's how it always goes, right? So that is our MLB preview. And to wrap up the episode, JJ Redick and LeBron James are starting a podcast. Wow. So a few weeks ago, JJ Redick was complaining on national television about the state of the media, specifically in the NBA, and how, you know, he could post a video on YouTube breaking down all the games in which the Pelicans have used Zion Williamson as the primary ball handler in their offense and how effective it is and all that kind of stuff. And he said it'll get like 100,000 views. But a clip of him saying something kind of controversial gets millions and millions and millions of clicks. So his thing is like, do people want to just argue about dumb basketball things, or do they actually, like, does the audience actually want to be educated? Like, where is the line between sensationalism and actual journalism, where his role and Stephen A. Smith and everyone else at ESPN, like, where their role lies and all that kind of stuff? And I would imagine from that kind of, not an outburst, but from that passionate monologue kind of thing he gave on ESPN, I would imagine that's how this podcast spawned. And he's doing it with the greatest basketball player of all time and probably the smartest basketball player of all time, LeBron James. Pretty insane duo there to start a podcast. I gotta imagine it's not even going to be one time a week. It might be once a month. It's called Mind the Game. So I think it's going to be pretty interesting. I'll give it a listen. I love LeBron. So hearing him strictly talk about basketball, that was the exact quote that I was used. Strictly analyzing basketball. That's a good sell to a lot of people. So I'm pretty excited to see what they cook up there with that duo. All right, that'll do it for this episode of From My Point of View. I appreciate you as always. Thank you all for listening. Have a great rest of your week. Enjoy the first weekend of March Madness, and we'll talk to you all next Tuesday. Started out with nothing, I was hungry. Now I got a couple niggas, bitches on me. Fuck nigga, I don't wanna be your homie. I had to make a couple bands by my lonely. I had to make a couple bands by my lonely. I had to make a couple bands by my lonely. I had to make a couple bands by my lonely. Fuck nigga, I don't wanna be your homie. All I wanna do is count commas. Count up. I had to make a couple bands for the come up. Come up. Got kicked out the house, I had no option. Mama. I was going through it with my mama. Jugging and finessing, had to play it raw. Smoking weed, dodging feds, cause my head hard. Damn. Dropped out, I said, fuck all of y'all. Imagine pulling up to your school in the best car. I was born in 94, I got the tattoo. I just took his bitch, that's what that cash do.